Meva, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Meva.
And this is Janine M. Milam. And we are both members of the Fifth Tradition group. And I remember I had pretty much burned a bunch of bridges at another fellowship and was kind of confused as to what I was going to do next. And a friend suggested I try this meeting. And she just said, "So what are you going to do different this time?" And I said, "Well, I really don't know what I'm going to do different. I've tried a lot of things. I don't know." And she said, "Well, that sounds like a good answer. Why don't I sponsor you?" And that was a blessing because it made me feel a part of and like I could start somewhere fresh. And so with that, I give you Janine.
Good job.
Hey, I'm Janine, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
That's funny you told that story. In all my years of sponsoring, I have never ever walked up to somebody and said, "I'm going to sponsor you." and for some reason, and I had no intentions of doing it that night, and the words just came out of my mouth, right? It just came out of my mouth, and we've been grateful to be with each other. Let's hope that God works on my mouth tonight, too, as well. So with that, I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Jerry, for asking me to speak. And I'm really excited to see some of my friends and home group members and sponsees here tonight. It's really touching. It's really touching to have you guys here. It means a lot to me. It really does. I love the third step prayer. I say it every morning. That's how I start off and get myself started. It's on page 63 in the big book. But there's one line I particularly wanted to bring up tonight, and that's the part that says, "Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power and on." And the way I was taught that line was, take away my difficulties. It's not so Janine feels better. It's not so that I get to have this happy and stress-free life or anything. It's so that I go through these things so I can bear witness and so I can show how this program works, how my higher power works. And that line is just so very, very important to me. And I've had a lot going on lately here, and I'll share a little bit of that later, but I'm really grateful to be able to serve tonight and get me out of my head a little bit, too. So, start at the beginning. I am from Lima, Ohio. Does anybody know where Lima, Ohio is? Oh, gosh. All right, then you'll agree with me, then, that it has no redeeming qualities whatsoever, right? All right. I don't think it has anything to do with the bean. But if you've ever seen the TV show Glee, it's actually based in Lima, Ohio. And I actually had been in the Glee Club in Lima, Ohio, so I'm an original Gleek, I guess it is. But I'm from Lima, and it's a medium-sized town, a very industrial town. And it was like in the middle of farmland. It's like this one little small town in the middle of farmland and everything. So that's where I grew up. I was raised by a single mother. My parents divorced when I was 5. It was just my mom, my sister, and I. My dad lived nearby, about 5 miles away, and he was definitely very much in our lives, but it was pretty much my sister and I. And my sister was a bully to the nth degree. She, I would call her a sociopath. You know, at the humiliation, the horrors, the not knowing when the next time the rug was going to be pulled out from underneath me. We were only a year apart difference in age, and I'm the older one. And honestly, I tell you what, I'm a year older than she is, and I don't think she's ever forgiven me for being first, right? And to this day, you know, I got to drive first, I got to do this first, I got to do that first, and that she didn't like that. But I really spent my last couple of years at home listening to her tell me how ugly, stupid, and how I had no friends. And she said this to me every day. And even though I knew those things weren't true, it just erodes your self-esteem. You know, even to this day, I really battle with worrying about what y'all think of me, you know, all of that, because it was so ingrained in me from the very, very beginning. But I'm not an alcoholic today because of all that, but it does play a part in my story, and I'll share that with you. I don't remember the first time I drank. And to tell you the truth, and then I don't know that I'll ever really know the answer, and it's not really important now, is I know some of you all take your first drink and it's like, oh, this is your elixir to life, right? You're just right with the world. It makes you comfortable with everybody and at ease with everybody. That wasn't my story. I really feel like I crossed some invisible line in my life and no longer had a choice in whether I drank or not. So I don't feel like I was born alcoholic. There's none of it in my family anywhere. Let me grab my drink. So, I don't know, but there's no doubts in my mind I'm one today, and that's the important part. It really is. So, I don't remember my first drink at all, but I do remember the first time I got drunk. I had was mad at the world, and I was probably about 17, and yeah, I was a goody two-shoes, so people just didn't invite me to things. I was in the orchestra, and I worked tons of hours, and mostly I worked tons of hours so that I didn't have to be at home, because home wasn't a safe place for me. So I just was always out of the house, but I didn't get invited to parties and stuff because I was working, and mostly I was a goody two-shoes, and people didn't really have an incentive to invite me. So the first time I got drunk, I was mad at the world. The sister had done something else humiliating to me. My parents wouldn't do anything about it. And I was furious, so I got in my mom's liquor cab. I'm sure I was mad at a boyfriend, too. And I got my mom's liquor cabinet, and I grabbed down her bottle of bourbon, and I drank as much of it as I could possibly tolerate. Just threw it down my throat. And, oh, God, it was horrible. In fact, it never in my worst drinking days would I drink bourbon, to tell you the truth. I never recovered from that. But drink everything else. And have. But I drank all that, and then I got in the car and I went to work. And I worked at Ponderosa. And they had, for some reason, they had me flipping the steaks that night, and that, which was really a nice treat because they never let the girls cook the steaks, right? It was just a totally a guy thing. You know, this is back in the 1980 or something like that. And I couldn't cook the steaks. I was either burning them or I was sending them out raw. And my manager asked me to run the register instead. And I'm thinking, that's kind of crazy. If I can't cook steaks, why they won't let me handle the money? But they did. And instead of doing that, I went just walk. He said, why don't you go back and do the dishes? And I went back and started walking right out the door and got in my car and passed out. I came to many hours later, and the parking lot was empty. It was all dark. And, you know, that meant that everybody I worked with had come out the back door, saw me pass out of my car, and left. I went to work a couple days later, and nobody said a word to me about it. Not one single word to me about it. And I was, like, scared to death that something, you know, I was going to get fired or something like that. It was months later I finally got the guts to come ask my boss, you know, why I hadn't gotten in trouble for that. And he says, Janine, you're a good kid. He says, you look like you were beating yourself up bad enough. We didn't need to make it worse. So I kind of got away with that. A lot of why I didn't get in trouble much in high school, too, was because I had that sister keeping an eye on everything. You know, she knew everything I did. There was no keeping any secrets in that town, and especially for a sister who's one grade below you at school, and we all knew the same people. But when I went off to college, I went to Ohio State University, the Ohio State University. Actually, my cell phone rings the Ohio State fight song. So anyway, I got out, because I'd worked so much, I'd saved up enough money to not have to work while I was actually physically in school. And all of a sudden, I was free. I was free to do whatever I wanted to. Nobody watching what time I came in, left, who I spent my time with. You know, to criticize me. I got to be a whole, totally new person. And I ended up meeting up with through a girlfriend, a fraternity, and I met husband number one, father of my children, in college or at the beginning of the years, and I became a little sis for their fraternity. It was a scholarship fraternity. It wasn't like the geek ones where they all had money. These were guys who were on full scholarships because they didn't have any money. But I just got really involved with the fraternity, and I really felt part of. And you know, the fraternity guys drink a lot. And so I drank with them, and it seemed like we'd drink on Tuesday night. We're a little sis meeting, so we'd drink after that, and we'd drink on Saturday nights, and then we'd drink on Friday nights, and it just seemed like, well, Sunday you're hungover, so you'd drink on Sunday too, and then it just seemed like I did a lot of partying in college, a lot of partying. I really had a lot of fun doing that, though. I really felt like I fit in, and I could drink a lot. I really had a high tolerance to drink. And in fact, when all the other girls were passed out, I was still going. I was so proud of myself for that. I thought that was cool. It made me cool. And actually, I had a secret that the room started spinning a little bit, and I'd just go in the bathroom, make myself get sick, and drink some water, and then I could go right back out there and drink with the guys. So I was the only girl hanging out with the guys at the end of the night, and I liked that. Of course, I got out of college and got my MRS degree. I mean, I married that boyfriend and became a Mrs. And we, MRS degree, right? And we moved to Atlanta, and got married and got a house and started having kids. And alcohol was really not part of all that. You know, I mean, we'd maybe drink some on the weekends if social, but not every weekend. You know, if we were getting together with some friends, I don't think he and I ever really partied much, just the two of us. So I know, you know, I didn't drink at all both times I was pregnant. So I know, at least at that point in my life, alcohol was not that important to me, right? I know I certainly had a choice in whether I drank or not. That marriage ended at no fault of my own. And he would tell you that too. And those were his own words. But I immediately met husband number two. And it just didn't occur to me that every time we got together, we drank together. He drank and I drank with him. And somebody called it tonight. What did she call that? It's a sympathy drinker. You know, he'd want one more, and so I'd have one with him. And I can tell you from the time he and I ended up marrying him, from the time we started living together until the day I got sober, I drank every day for the next 13 years. Now, I didn't drink huge quantities always, certainly not in the beginning, but slowly over time, I started drinking a little bit earlier in the evening, a little bit stronger drinks. You know, I switched to from beer to wine, then to, you know, rum and Diet Coke, and then it would be more and more rum and less Diet Coke. But this was just like so gradual. And he and I were having a great time. We both had two kids, and we were having a lot of fun raising those kids. And there really weren't any troubles. But I look back on it, and there were all these signs that he was drinking too much. I mean, he'd come home from work, and he had a long drive. He'd always have a tall boy that he'd have to throw away. And I came out to find out later there was a second one, too, that he'd drank, and I didn't see. And anyway, so I'm not saying it's his fault that I'm an alcoholic. I picked every one of those drinks up myself and chose to drink it. But some number of years into it, I started realizing that I started playing games with myself with the drinking. I started saying, okay, I'm home from work, and I have a pretty nice career, and I work really hard, and always have. And, you know, I'd get home from work, and I'd say, okay, I'm not going to drink tonight until after the kids are in bed. And I ended up drinking after dinner. And then it got to me, and I was drinking, just gave up on that, and I said, okay, I'm not going to drink until after dinner. And I'd get home from work, and I'd have a drink. And it got to the point where I'd walk in the door, and he'd hand me a drink. And I'm sitting there thinking, he's nice, how much he cares about me. I walk in the door from working hard, bringing home the bacon, and he's got a drink right there for me. How nice. You know, I didn't think this was a problem. It didn't even occur to me that he was doing that so that he could drink. Or I came home, and he smells like alcohol, because he had just made himself one, too. Well, I found out later that he had been drinking a lot more than that. I didn't really realize it. But I'm so busy. I'm not paying attention to things. I'm working really hard. I got the four kids I'm trying to do. You know, I've got some other things I'm involved in, and I'm just not paying attention. And except I'm playing these darn games with myself. And in fact, I've always been on a diet now, but always been on a diet. One of the really big clues that I was an alcoholic, and basically the first time I really had admitted it to myself, is that I would go on a diet based on whether I could drink or not. And I did Weight Watchers. And you can drink on Weight Watchers, you just have to count your points. But I was ending up having to save all my points for drinking. And I wasn't really eating much, but I did lose some weight. But that didn't hold up very long. Then they came out with the Atkins diet. No carbs, right? Whiskey has no carbs. I could drink as much as I wanted to, and I loved it. And I would do that for a while, too. You know, it occurred to me one day that you know what, normal people, my neighbors, don't have to pick their diets based on whether they can drink or not, right? And you know, it started. I drank and drove every day. You guys, I drank and drove every day with my kids in the car, and I drank every day with other people's kids in my car. You know, kids, they're always thirsty, right? Kids are always thirsty. Heck, I'm thirsty too. And they get in the car, and I'd always put my drink in a big Tupperware cup. And so to mask it, because nobody thinks there's alcohol in a Tupperware cup, right? And the kids would get in the car, and they're thirsty, and they say, Mommy, can we have a sip of your drink? And there's no, you can't. And they, oh, it's one of Mom's special drinks. And, you know, when I do drop-off and pick-ups for things my kids were doing, I'd always wanted to do the drop-off instead of the pick-up, because I knew I would have had more to drink. Tell you the truth, I've never had a DUI. I've never gotten caught. I actually got pulled over three separate times in my life when I was drunk. and no one, I even got arrested one time, and nobody thought to give me a breathalyzer test, so whatever. It has not happened for me. But, you know, that was getting pretty bad. And, you know, we'd have, my husband and I, we would go to the high school football games. This is in Peachtree City, right? I don't know if you, and they, we'd go to the high school football games, and we would leave the games at halftime so we could go home and drink. Now, we justified it to everybody that the team was that bad and we were tired of seeing them lose. But, you know, we'd leave. And then basically, we had to leave because we wanted to drink. And even when we did family events, my parents live in Roswell, and we would, you know, every family event, we'd come with our little cooler and leave it in the car, and it'd have some ice in our cups and our liquor in it. And we'd always, my husband was like, no, what time are we leaving? What time are we leaving? And it wasn't because we didn't want to spend time with the families. We wanted to be able to, we could have a drink or two family's house, but we couldn't drink the way we wanted to drink. So, you know, we always get out, and even with four kids in the car and an hour drive in front of us, we pull over at the Quick Trip and get, you know, our sodas and make our drinks and drink those all the way home. And so I think how many times I was part of family events and left earlier than really was appropriate or wanted to because I was drinking. So I was making a lot of decisions based on my wanting to drink. And you know, some of that is really, really hard to see until, you know, been sober a little while, look back at how much alcohol affected my decisions, diets, eating, what time I leave work, you know, what I do with my kids and what I don't do with my kids. You know, I was making all these decisions around being able to drink. So things got kind of bad in the marriage, as you might expect, and he wasn't working, and he was drinking a lot more than I was. And I know we're not supposed to call anybody else an alcoholic, but he's an alcoholic. And he, and it is in his family a good bit. And I actually said to him one day that, you know, I think we're alcoholics. I think maybe we should go to AA. And I wasn't saying that to him because I wanted to get help. I wanted to get him help. And I didn't know about Al-Anon at all. But, you know, he said, I'm not an alcoholic. You probably are, so you can go get help, but I'm not going. And, of course, I was not in any mental state I hadn't had enough consequences to think I wanted to get help yet. So I did not do that. There was a really nice example of AA. His stepfather, so my ex-stepfather-in-law, was a member of, is still a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time that I remember, he had about 13 years of sobriety. And they'd come to visit us from North Carolina. And he would just always slip away and go to a meeting when they came to visit. And I remember thinking how pathetic. He's been sober 13 years and he's still struggling to stay away from a drink. I mean, that's what I thought. You know, I had no idea he hadn't wanted to drink in a long time. He was going to meetings because he wanted to. He enjoyed doing that when he came out of town. But here's how selfish and self-centered I am, and I generally stay at that point, too, that I'd say that's his problem. He's drinking, I'm drinking, it's my home. That's his problem. And I mean, that's just, you know, I didn't know it didn't bother him. And never once did this man ever say to us anything about our drinking. He didn't talk to us about it. He just was just this calm, quiet example of how AA was. And he was always even keeled and polite and never said anything to us. And actually, after I was about 6 months sober, I started really getting comfortable with being an alcoholic. Instead of being embarrassed about it, I was being proud about it. And I found a way to contact him and let him know I'm in sobriety. So we're Facebook friends. And every year on my AA birthday, he comes in and you know, sends me a message or something like that. And since I'd forgotten, you know, you already mentioned my home group is the fifth tradition, and my sobriety date is February 28th, 2008. So I left that part out. But so that was really kind of him to do that. So here I was. My marriage is falling apart. I kick him out thinking he's the problem. I'm sure he's the problem. And the thing is here I am in Peachtree City, a very family-oriented place to live, and I didn't know how to make friends. I didn't know how to meet other people. I even think this is before Match.com or something like that. I'm not even really sure. And I didn't know where to meet people, so I went out to the bars. And what did I do? I found other people who were single and lonely and alcoholics, and we started hanging out together. And we drank a lot, and we just fed each other on it. I'd swear to myself, I'm not going out tonight. I'm not going out tonight. And somebody would call me and say, hey, why don't you come and join us? And I'd immediately go do it. I was so crazy lonely. Well, my oldest daughter had gone off to college by this point, and it was just my our younger daughter and myself, and you know, my behavior was just horrible to these years. You all know what drunk middle-aged women at bars are like, and I don't have to explain any of that. But this was quite an embarrassment for my kids. and, you know, people coming over, me staying out late. You know, I always came home, but, I mean, I have to wake up in the morning and look outside to see if my car was there and whether I had my keys or not. And almost always it wasn't. From time to time, I'd ask my kids to come and pick me up. And, you know, I thought I was being a good mom, showing them a good example, saying, look at me, I'm not drinking and driving. I'm letting you come and pick me up. And I was just a huge embarrassment to them. You know, it was just horrible. It ended up that my youngest daughter was so disgusted with me that she ended up moving to her father. And at the time, I justified it as he's a family unit because he's remarried and got some stepkids, and that, you know, I was doing the best thing for my daughter. You know, she'd have, instead of being with a single mom, she would. The thing is my drinking made me lose my daughter. I mean, when I had children, I had every intention to finish raising both those kids, and I did not do that with that second child. And She actually never spoke to me again until about 2.5 years of sobriety. And because I always forget to leave this part out at the end, is that she and I are extremely close today. In fact, I'm going to have my first grandchild in about 10 days, and she wants me to be the first one to hold her. So that relationships heal in this program. But the thing is that it didn't happen when Janine wanted it to happen. It happened on God's timetable, and God provided a wonderful opportunity for us to get close again and get to know each other. But it took a number of years, and I just had to get out of the way. But here I am drinking. My child's gone. I don't have anybody looking out for me, paying attention to what I'm doing. And I even quit my favorite job ever. It was a demanding job, and I went and worked for the CDC, which was a government job, and you don't have to work real hard for government jobs. And I could do, you know, I could do my job with my hand tied behind my back, and basically that's what I was doing. I mean, I pretty much was pretty drunk all the time, and I mean, the people I was hanging out with, it's like I kept lowering that bar a little lower and a little lower and a little lower. The kind of people I was hanging out with at the beginning, you know. Got worse and worse and worse and worse, and behaviors got worse and worse and worse, and I thought I was having fun. That's the sad thing, is I truly thought I was having fun. But things started getting bad, and I actually started drinking in the mornings. I learned that a hair of the dog helped a lot, and I was actually starting to drink on the way to work, and that was pretty bad. And one of my alcoholic friends actually called my mom and told them they were worried about me. And this is somebody who had just gotten out of jail and has called my mom telling me he was worried about me. And I actually went to treatment. I went to Anchor Hospital. I went there and I said, you know, I wanted to check it out. I didn't know anything about rehabs or anything like that. And they said, okay, let's admit you now. I said, no, I've got a conference in Orlando to go to with my boyfriend, and I am speaking at it, and I have to, so I need to be there. And so I went good, but I promised him that when I flew back in, you know, 5 days later, I would come straight to Anchor Hospital and check myself in. Had a great time, got professional awards, had a great time with the boyfriend, awesome week, and then I drive myself to Anchor Hospital. But I was good that day. I didn't drink, and I didn't realize that detoxes you had to have been drinking. You got to detox, right? And so I checked myself into Anchor, and they said, no, we need you detoxing. I said, you're telling me I need to go home and drink? And they said, well, no, but you know, we can't take you not detoxing. So I stopped at the next door and got something to drink on the way home. Get home, and they called me back and said, we made a mistake. Can you come back? And I said, no, I've been drinking now. I can't come back, which is ludicrous because, you know, I drank and drove all the time. But I did go the next morning, and I was there. And I'll tell you what, I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. I know they brought meetings in, AA meetings in there, and I thought the people who brought those meetings in there were pretty pathetic. What are they doing here on a Friday night? They've got no life. How pathetic. And I really looked down at him. But when I checked out, the doctor, his diagnosis was that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I was a situational drinker. And you know what? I knew I wasn't a situational drinker. The situation was it was Tuesday. Or right? The situation was it's after work. So I knew it was wrong, but what he had given me was just like this golden ticket to go back to family and friends who were concerned about me, saying, hey, look at me, I'm not an alcoholic. But I did go to some AA meetings in Peachtree City, and they were small meetings, and I don't know if they were really solution-based, but I didn't know any difference. And I was sitting there comparing myself to everybody, like, he's old and I'm young, or she's young and I'm old, or she's a stay-at-home mom, I have to work. You know, I just didn't identify with any of these people at all. All I was sitting, I didn't hear anything that they said. Maybe they were solution-based and I wasn't listening. Very possible, because they were all sober. And I'd go to these meetings and I'd go out afterwards, and I was going home and I was lonely as crap. And my friend would call and say, let's go out. And I'd go out, right, you know, leave an AA meeting and go out to the bars. And I was doing that sometimes. So this boyfriend of mine, who lived in Charlotte, North Carolina, we had been dating on and off, you know, long distance for a year. He suggested, why don't you move to Charlotte and we could date like normal people. And I heard, why don't you move to Charlotte, we'll fall in love and live happily ever after. And so I thought, I was sure this relationship, the new town, getting away from my people, places, and things would solve my problems. You know, that's what they tell you in treatment, right? You know, change your playmates and playgrounds, right? And so that's what I was going to do. Got a job in Charlotte, and they moved me. They paid to move me there. And I get to Charlotte. I sold my house, and... because I'd gone bankrupt through all this. I mean, I couldn't buy another house. And I moved there to be with this guy. And I the first week I was there, he's like, whoa, when I said date like normal people, that means like Saturday night date. He didn't mean to like, you know, live together or be together or anything like that. And because I was in corporate housing for the first month. And so I assumed after that, he and I would live together. And that he had no intentions of being my knight in shining armor. None at all. I was devastated. Absolutely devastated. I had spent some of this money. I hated my new job. I just hated it. And I couldn't get back to Atlanta if I wanted to. I didn't have the money that they had my signing bonus or pay to move back or anything like that. You know, I had moved there just really not thinking through anything. But, oh, I'm so good at justifying my behavior. Are any of y'all like that? I can justify my decisions all day long. So there I am in Charlotte. I don't know anybody at all. I'm going back to the bars because that's how I know that where I can find other people who drink like I do. And you know, every night I go out and I meet people and I have these brand new friends for a night and never hear from them again. And the next night I go out and have a good old time at the bar and drinking with strangers again and never hear from them again. And it was a pretty torturous time. That boyfriend and I broke up a couple times, but 3 months into my stay in Charlotte. I got to a point where I didn't want to live and I didn't want to die, and I was drinking in the morning again, and pretty much I wasn't drinking at work, but I was drinking pretty much constantly of that. I would drink Crystal Light, because I'm always on that diet, right? Crystal Light and vodka at the end. And the reason I would drink it is that, you know, any drink, the whiskey and Diet Coke, the Coke would spoil overnight, right? But if I was drinking Crystal Light and vodka, you know, I didn't even have to get out of bed in the morning. I just reach over and take that drink that was just still sitting there and to get me out of bed, I'd have a drink. And I did that for like maybe last 3 or 4 weeks of my drinking. But I don't want to tell the whole long story about it, but I was at his house and he didn't want me there and I was drunk and I don't remember anything of it at all. But he called the police he tried to get me to go home and I wouldn't. And he called the police on me to get me out of the house, and the police finally got me into a cab. I only found this out like 6 weeks later when he told me what happened. He would not talk to me after this. And I woke up the next morning. I'm at home. I don't have my car. I just have my keys. And I had to call a car for a taxi. And I had to take that taxi and go pick up my car. I went to work. I always went to work somehow or another. I didn't miss work, but you know, I wasn't functioning there at work, and he wouldn't talk to me and tell me what happened because he worked at the same place I did and same floor, and I thought my life was absolutely over. I just didn't see any way out of the hole I had dug myself in. The financial problems, the where I live problem, that I just didn't know what I was going to do, and you know, I didn't want to live, but I didn't want to die either, and. I got really super drunk, and I called my mom, who lives here in Atlanta in Roswell, and said, Mom, if you don't come and get me, I don't know that I'll live through the weekend. And, okay, I want to really make a really strong point out. I didn't believe in God at all. Zero, zip, nada. Don't even talk to me about it, right? Just dig in my heels. I don't have to believe in God at all. But I made this phone call to my mom, and instead of being in Atlanta and a five-hour drive away, and that's without any prep time. They had gone to Cherokee to gamble, and they were on their way home on this trip, and they were at the point where they could have gone north to Charlotte or south to Atlanta. And so instead of being 5 hours away, they were only an hour and a half away. And they came and got me, and they took me back to Atlanta, and my mom's a nurse, so I detoxed at her house. I just slept the whole weekend. And she took all my alcohol, which it was a year. I was a year sober before I got over being mad that she took all my alcohol and didn't pay me for any of it. But anyway, I had some good stuff in there, like Kahlua and stuff. But And then they brought me back to Atlanta. And, you know, I was new at this job. I couldn't take the time off to go to a treatment center. And, you know, I started going to a psychiatrist, a psychologist, whatever. And you know, I think that might help. But I did go to an AA meeting. And there were people there, right? So there's people there, and I'm numb, and you know, but I'm so broken at this point. It's just so at the bottom of my barrel that I just tried to do what they told me to. I'd love to say I picked up just one white chip. When I lived in Peachtree City, I'd picked up three white chips and probably needed more. I just didn't pick them up. Here I was in Charlotte, and I guess it was February 10th when I picked my first one up, but I drank two more times in 3 weeks. And I would like to say I had really good reasons for that, but the last night I drank, I had gone to the psychologist and we had discussed my sister and all these overwhelming feelings of resentment. I mean, resentment, resentment, resentment. I mean, everybody else in my life wrapped up into one. My resentments towards them aren't even close to my resentment towards my sister. So resentments are like a powerful part of my story. And I couldn't handle those feelings. I couldn't deal with those feelings. I had no solution. And I pulled over at a bar and I started drinking. And I was doing shots of tequila with a guy that likes guys, and having a good conversation. And literally, I heard this voice. I heard a voice say to me, "Janine, you can't spend the rest of your life sitting in bars talking to strangers." I paid my bill, and there was a 10 p.m. meeting in Charlotte, and it was candlelight, and I figured I could go there, because some people didn't know me already, because I'd been going for a couple weeks, and I figured nobody would see me, or I thought people knew me. I mean, that's all my ego, right? It had only been a couple weeks, and I picked up what turns out to be my last white chip. I was drunk when I picked up my last white chip, and if you had told me I was going to stay sober on that white chip, I wouldn't have believed you for anything, but what was different is I heard a voice, and it didn't even occur to me a while later that what that was. But so I threw myself into AA. You know what? I was crushed. I was broken. I was at a meeting, and somebody kind of knew. So I said, "Who would make a good sponsor?" She says, "One of those two women over there." And I went up and asked the one that was standing closest, and she was my sponsor. And you know, I didn't know how to get sober and stay sober, but the women in this program know how to. And all you have to do is ask for help. But I've got to ask for help. I've got to do the work, and they're more than glad to, you know, to help me if I'm willing to do the work. And you know what? I didn't have any other solutions, so I just did everything she suggested to me. I mean, nobody's ever told me to do anything. You know, nobody's ever ordered me around, but she's given me suggestions. If I wanted what she had, I had to do what she did. And so I kind of followed her around a good bit, and I did what she did. She went to meetings every day. I went to meetings every day. You know, sometimes I would, especially there at the beginning, I would go to multiple meetings a day. I mean, I'd get off work and go to a 6 o'clock meeting. I would stay a little late, get to know people. I'd maybe stop at a drive-thru, get something to eat, and I would go to another meeting at 8 o'clock. And if I was still squirreling my head after that, I'd go to the 10 o'clock meeting, because I was so, loneliness was my demon. And I'd go on home, I just didn't trust myself being there alone. And I just stayed in meetings, what I did. I didn't do that very long, but I did it as long as I needed to do it too. But I got in the middle of AA. I got to know some people, and I started doing these steps, and I started getting a little bit of relief. And I remember when I was like 3 months sober, my sponsor suggested to me that I needed to start reaching out to newcomers. And I'm like, I only got 3 months of sobriety here. You know, what can I do for a newcomer? And she goes, "You know how to be sober 3 months." And so, like I said, it's a suggestion, but I usually took her suggestions, and especially at this point. And I was at a really big, huge meeting, you know, like 300 people meeting on Friday nights in Charlotte. And there was a girl standing outside smoking a cigarette, and she just looks scared to death. And I went up to her and said, "Hey, is this your first meeting?" And she said, "No, I've been coming for a week." But I found out later it was her first meeting. We started talking, and I said, "Well, let's go grab some coffee." And we went out and got some coffee together. And turns out, you know, I'd say things like, "Yeah, I'd drive home and I'd cover my eye up so that I could only see one line in the road." And she goes, "Oh, I used to do that." And you know, we started telling these stories that we tell each other, right? Immediately it was this identification. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks that, oh my God, that's why this thing works, right? It's one alcoholic sharing their experience with another alcoholic. We identify with each other. That's why talking to my mom, who loves me dearly, my kids who love me dearly, that doesn't work. You know, if somebody else who's going through just what I went through 3 months ago, right? And we really identified. We ended up staying friends for a good while until some things took her off in different directions. But even if I had never seen her again, it occurred to me that that's why this thing works. I was so high after that evening of talking with her that, you know, it really wouldn't have mattered if I'd seen her again. I got so much out of the experience myself. But anyways, I got myself a running crowd. I found friends that were like me and my age group and stuff like that. And we did a lot of things together. We went out to dinner together, you know, tried different meetings together. I got my home group. I got my year and started speaking and was sponsoring women, and I'm doing AA. Like, I was really doing AA, and I felt part of. I actually got back together with that boyfriend. In fact, we ended up dating on and off until I moved here. But I remember I was like about 13 months sober, and my mom told me something about my childhood, and I was really upset. It just brought all this resentment just rolling right back at me. Fumed me, and I started thinking about it, and I started drawing things out of my memory and rehashing it, making it bigger and bigger and bigger in my head. And then one beautiful Saturday afternoon, I wanted to drink worse than anything. And I tried to get busy doing something, like tell you to, you know, get your mind off of it, do something like cleaning the refrigerator or something like that. It's like, hell, you know. So I tried to do that, but my head's going all nonstop all the time anyway. Still is to this day. And that didn't stop it. And I got on my knees and asked God to remove the obsession to drink. And that didn't help. And I picked up the phone and called a girlfriend of mine, another alcoholic. And she stayed on the phone with me until I could get a hold of my sponsor. I had called my sponsor and left her a message. And then my sponsor called me, so I had to meet her she met with me and we talked through it, and then I had to leave her to go to a meeting because I was meeting with a sponsee for the meeting, and then I was at the meeting, and then afterwards a friend that I had already had plans with was coming over, and by the end of that night I was on top of the world. Life was good, right? And just hours before, I wanted a drink worse than anything. And so I'm here to say, if you really want to stay sober, you know, all those things that they tell you to do to keep from drinking, they work. And for me, I needed every one of those things that they needed to drink. Just step back a second about, because obviously it sounds like I'm believing in God at this point. As I was about, God, this is huge. I was about three weeks sober after those three white chips, and I wanted a drink worse than anything then. And I remember talking to my sponsor on the phone saying I really, really wanted a drink bad. And she says, you're just going to need to find a power greater than yourself. And I said, that was not going to happen. What else could I do? And she said, I mean, I really had no intentions of doing any of it. And I'd close my ears when anybody would talk in the meeting about a higher power. And she says, okay, can you make me a list? And I said, oh, yes, a list. I can do that. And, you know, and she said, well, make me a list. If there were a God, what would that God be like? Like, she's trying to trick me. And it worked. I made this list, and it's really simple, like a God that let me laugh again, a God that like made me feel hugged or loved or whatever, stuff like that. But I made this list, and about 3 weeks after that, it occurred to me that I haven't had wanted to have a drink. I'm still not feeling real happy with the world, but I hadn't wanted to have a drink since I made that damned list. And all of a sudden, the clouds parted and the sun started shining. And, you know, I entered that phase where we call what a pink cloud. I called it a pink fog because that's kind of more accurate, right? But it just occurred to me that God had done for me what I couldn't do for myself. That this obsession to drink had been completely removed, just like instantly. And really that faith had not wavered a bit. My faith is really simple. I don't think about it too much. I don't overanalyze it a bunch. You can ask me if I believe this or believe that. I don't know. I just believe. I believe that I'm not in control, that somebody else is, and I have complete faith in that. I really, truly, totally do. But here is somebody who just so fearful of the God thing, because who wants to feel like they're out of control, right? I had always been in control, except for the drinking part, right? But everything else, I had been in control. So I didn't want to give up that control. And I'll tell you what, it feels so good today not to be that in control. You know, I just have to go where the path leads me for, and I truly do trust. Anyway, I need to get closer here. I got involved with AA, and I've stayed involved with AA a lot. I started doing general service work, and I started going to the jails and the men's prisons. So I've even told my story in a men's maximum security prison in North Carolina. And I'll tell you what, that those gentlemen in that meeting, nod their heads and laugh at the exact same points you all do. And, they're just really grateful that people are treating them like human beings. And so I got a lot of gratitude from my experience with that. One of my favorite stories about, I went to women's jail one Friday a month. And now you go in there and everybody's in their orange jumpsuits and you don't know if they're listening to you. Most of them aren't necessarily from right around there anyway, and they go off back wherever they're going. And I kind of was feeling like I'm doing all this work, and I feel like nobody's hearing it, right? I just have no clue, and I'm the only one who's staying sober from doing the effort. And I was at that big meeting I was telling you about in Charlotte, and I was in the ladies' restroom, and this lovely young woman comes up to me and says, "Hey, do you remember me?" And I was like, I meet a lot of people. And she goes, "You spoke at the jail. I heard you tell your story." And she goes, "I didn't even know I was an alcoholic until I heard your story." And she introduced me to her sponsor. And, I'm thinking, God, higher power, I don't ever need any more affirmation that the work that we're doing in these treatment centers or in the jails and the prison are worth the effort. Right there was a person. In fact, she had texted me when she had had a year sobriety, and I showed up to see her pick up her first year chip. And, like I said, I mean, it gives me chills to think about the work we do is so important there. And even though we don't get immediate gratification or acknowledgement for the work we're doing, I have a lot more appreciation for the people who do that. So if you ever want to try any of that stuff, it's pretty cool. I've gone through a lot in sobriety. I have a good life, I really do. But after five years or something like that, I decided it was time to come back to Atlanta. That relationship was just never going to work out. My parents are here, and one of my daughters was here at the time, and it was time to come back to Atlanta. And I tell you what, here it is again, just trusting, right, and not rushing things. The way Janine thinks in the past is like, I got an idea, I got to go right at it. And then I start justifying everything about it, and I go right at it. And this time I didn't do that. It was actually my mom's suggestion I moved back to Atlanta. I said, sounds like a good idea. Let me run it by my sponsor. Called my sponsor. She goes, it might be a good idea. Let's pray about it. We did a lot of talking about it. I didn't do any rushing. Took my time looking for a job. Didn't just take anything just for the hell of it. And I just, when you're doing the right thing, everything just unfolds, right? I've always been told that if I have to justify my behavior, it's probably something I shouldn't be doing, right? And that was the case with this. When I was doing the right thing and not trying to force Janine's will on the situation, it just unfolded in front of me. I feel like I always wanted to be more sober than I was. I always wanted to be more sane than I was. And I'd always ask my sponsors, why am I not, better yet? And she says, you're exactly where you're supposed to be. And, what I've learned is that there's not much I can do to rush my recovery along. There's a whole lot I can do to slow it down. And me getting in the way and my ego and my pride and my self-will are exactly those things that are going to do it for me. I've had a rough summer. I was unemployed for 4 months. Never in my life thought I'd be unemployed that long. That got kind of really, really tough. My father passed away about a week and a half ago in Cleveland, Ohio. And my boyfriend moved to California 3 days later, and that was all last week, right? And so it's been a pretty tough summer for me. But I'll tell you what, not once during any of it have I thought about taking up a drink. And I'll tell you what, if I talked, and I've talked to tons of people who have relapsed, right? Tons of them. And then they'll sit there and say, my relationship ended, I drank. Or I lost my job, I drank. Or, somebody died, I drank. It's like, all those three things happened to me all at one time, and I never thought about having a drink. There is not one good reason to drink again. Not one. And, I may not feel great about any of it. I may not do everything right or say everything right or act perfectly about it at all like that, but I didn't drink. Now, one of the things through all of this is I didn't stop going to meetings. I didn't stop sponsoring. I didn't stop doing my service commitments. I stayed in the middle of AA. And I'll tell you what, this is a lifeline that you can't duplicate anywhere else. It's truly amazing. And that's why I say, that part of the third step prayer there is take away my difficulties at Victory Open and bear witness that hopefully I can help somebody else out there. No, if I've gone through this and not drank, that you can too. And it's not a Janine thing. And I'm, like I say, I don't want anybody to think I'm not perfect or anything like that, but because I'm certainly not. I do a lot wrong. But the thing is, as long as I stay in touch with my prayers and meditation and the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous and my commitments, that because old Janine would have maybe blown off some of those commitments. Old Janine would have made excuses. Old Janine would have all those things. And even when it's been sometimes where I didn't want to do something, I wanted to isolate that, you know, I did this stuff anyways, because I've been taught to do this stuff anyways. You know, I was told a long time ago, too, that if I wanted to be better, a better person, that I look in the room and find the person I think is the best person I know, and then I try to act like them. And it's not like I think like I'm a good person inside, but I can act like a good person outside. And the more I act like a good person, the more I become a good person. Because it can become second nature to you then. And I'd like to believe that I'm doing that. But I'm really grateful to share my story with you tonight. I hope I was able to help somebody. And again, Jerry, thank you so much for asking me to speak. It's really nice to be of service right now. We're through some tough times, so I'm really grateful. Thanks.